When was the last time you felt like you had the power to change the world?
I feel like I knew very early on that Occupy Wall Street was going to be something truly magical.
This is Micah White, one of the very first organizers of the protest that became one of the largest in history.
As soon as we put out the idea at Adbusters, we basically sent out an email to our network saying, like, here's this idea, you know, let's occupy Wall Street. Within 24 hours, activists started organizing for it. And I think that that was kind of the moment that I got a flicker, like, this is actually going to work.
Can you imagine what that must have been like? I mean, I remember the mood in the country at the time. The unemployment rate was the highest it had been in years. People were still losing their homes, but the bankers, who had just crashed the economy, were doing okay. Occupy Wall Street was like a match tossed into a tank of gasoline. Plus, this was 2011. It was just months after the Arab Spring swept through the Middle East. It felt like nearly anything was possible.
The truly magical, most magical moment of Occupy Wall Street was when 700 people were arrested on the Brooklyn Bridge. When that happened, it triggered such astronomical growth of Occupy. Within like 24 hours, there was like 1,000 encampments around the world. And I remember like that it was just, the human mind couldn't even conceive what was going to happen next. I think that was the most beautiful moment of Occupy Wall Street, when you saw the power of a global social movement to kind of move faster than anything, you know, that humans have ever created.
Protesters occupied Zuccotti Park for 2 months. Encampments spread to cities around the world. And it's hard to believe, but it's now 6 years later. Micah White has had a lot of time to think about the protest he helped create, and he's come to a surprising conclusion.
I think the protest is broken. I think that the idea that Occupy Wall Street was a success, that Black Lives Matter was a victory, that the environmentalist movement is winning, I think these are dangerous ideas because they are untrue. I think instead that we live in a time when protest is broken.
Wow. Protest is broken? Really? I mean, how could that be? Black Lives Matter has marched and held vigils in cities across the country for years. Just this year alone, there was the Women's March on Washington and the Climate March. Protest is part of our political landscape, part of our political speech. How can it not be working?
I think that activists have been chasing a storyline that says if you do these certain behaviors, then your elected representatives will have to listen to you. I think that we've actually crossed into a time when all forms of protest as we know it are no longer effective in creating social change. Let's take the example of the environmentalist movement. If you ask someone like Greenpeace or 350.org, I'm sure they'll give you 100 victories that they've had in the last 9 months. But if we look at it objectively, we know that the environmentalist movement is failing. We know that we've experienced 7 months of the hottest temperatures on record. We know that the Great Barrier Reef is dying. We know that we're going through mass extinctions. So if we look at the larger picture, obviously environmentalism as we know it, 40 years of environmental activism has failed.
I'm Anne Strainchamps, and today on To the Best of Our Knowledge, do protests still matter? Micah White says no. In his book, The End of Protest, he says it's time to invent new ways to be the change you want to see in the world. And in fact, people like former Congressman Barney Frank agree. Here's what he told Steve Paulson.
Elected officials, particularly legislators, pay a great deal of attention to people who vote in their elections. That's not surprising. When you get large demonstrations, members of, particularly if they're down in Washington, members of Congress have no idea who the people are or where they're from or whether they're registered to vote. I cite to my friends the most effective organization, I think, pound for pound as a political lobbyist in the country, to one I generally disagree with, the National Rifle Association. Have you ever seen them hold a shoot-in?
Yeah, you tend not to see that.
What they do is everybody there registers to vote. And they inform their members of when legislation might be coming up or might be up for sponsorship. And they inundate you with phone calls. It sounds simple, but it's effective. Legislators are influenced to the extent that they're influenced by public opinion. Demonstrations are virtually useless. Now, I give as an example two things that I wish it were different. Mm-hmm. The Tea Party and Occupy. Both very angry about the existing situation. The Tea Party people got into politics and took over the Republican Party. The Occupy people chanted and protested, maybe smoked a little dope, had some drum circles, and had virtually no effect on the legislators.
So, I mean, but what you're pointing out is there would seem to be a difference between, I guess, what I would call raising consciousness, which it seems like that's what Occupy was about, as opposed to passing legislation.
Yeah, but what does raising consciousness do? There are a few cases where the demonstration calls attention to a previously undisclosed wrong, classically the civil rights movement.
Right.
But in general, people are aware of some things. And again, raising consciousness, what does that do, raising consciousness? Some of us, I include myself, are political activists. I was involved before I was in office. I'm involved after. Most people have only a limited amount of time and energy they're going to give to political activity. And the problem is when you tell people who feel strongly about something, here's what you should do. You should come to Washington and march up and down on the Mall. That's all they're going to do. There's a certain substitutability. Now, if you say to people, come to Washington and write a letter to your member of Congress, that'd be great, but they don't do that. And I'm afraid that much of what protests do is to become the substitute for more effective political action.
So I want to go back to the civil rights movement in the 60s, because it sounds like you were saying that is one case where protests did matter. I mean, that they were effective. They brought public attention to these horrible things that were happening, especially in the South. So
yes.
So why was that effective? And then what you're saying is these more recent protest movements largely have not been.
Because there was a very clear-cut issue here. There were things going on in a geographic region that people in the rest of the country did not know of. So that was a very specific situation where you could bring sunlight to something which you knew if the rest of the country understood they would deal with. It was a very concrete set of wrongs, very different than the general, more the public policy issues with regard to some of these other demonstrations.
Well, let me talk about another issue, certainly one of the most remarkable political movements of the last couple of decades in particular is what has happened with gay rights. I mean, just over the last two decades in particular, I mean, this has now become mainstream. It's become accepted both politically and legally. I mean, even gay marriage.
Let me sum it up for you. When I started out in politics 50 years ago, I thought that the fact that I was gay would be an obstacle to my ever being able to help bring about big social change. Over time, gay acceptability grew. Government's acceptability shrunk. So by the time I retired in 2012, my marrying Jim was more popular than my passing the financial reform bill.
Things have really turned around here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I mean, you tell a story about how you attended the March on Washington for lesbian, gay, and bi equal rights and liberation. And there was one thing in particular that just horrified you. I mean, sort of the seeing gay soldiers who were going to go out in sort of a dance routine.
Yeah, it was 93. I was frustrated by two things about the march. They bring hundreds of thousands of people to Washington and lobbying your members of Congress, writing, we're going to see your representatives and senators, was not on the agenda. It was a great big party. But in particular, there were eight or nine gay soldiers, all men, as I recall at the time, and they were waiting to go on stage and be introduced. And somebody thought, oh, wouldn't this be fun? Let's have them do a kick line like the Rockettes. Well, we're trying to get across, we're trying to win a battle for public opinion. We're trying to get across that these are soldiers and sailors and they want to be military people. And having them conform to this silly gay stereotype was about as stupid a thing as you can do. That whole march was a significant wasted effort because it was an emotional outpouring for us, but it failed to connect. And one of our strongest supporters, Senator Dick Durbin, a great supporter of LGBT rights, he said to me, Barney, we're not hearing from your people. All my colleagues are saying they only hear from the opposition. So the opposition was doing the smart thing from their standpoint. They were writing to members of Congress, going up to members of Congress, going to their office, saying, don't do this. And we were having military people in kick lines.
Hmm. So how do you explain the success of the gay rights movement over the last couple of decades? I mean, it has been amazing how this movement has really changed America.
Two things. So we did a very good job of mobilizing politically. Those demonstrations were a distraction, but we only had a few of those. But secondly, what helped us was reality. What changed it was this. Before Stonewall in 69, up through into the 70s, we were hiding. Beginning in the 70s, people started to come out. That's an interesting phrase in itself. basically, we stopped hiding.
So it would seem this is an example where actually maybe it wasn't so much political action that sort of changed the way the country saw about this. It was sort of these – I guess I would come back to the raising consciousness, people coming out normalizing.
But it had nothing to do with demonstrations. The demonstrations hurt more than they helped. Raising consciousness meant telling people the truth. So, yeah, that was helpful. But then – what that did was create a basis on which we could then act politically. It was a two-step process. Yes, we raised consciousness, but we raised consciousness in a sensible way, in a non-offensive way, in a non-demonstrative way. It was, by the way, Dad, I'm gay. Oh, I want you all to know on the team, I'm a lesbian. That's very different than this aggressive, in-your-face kind of activity that is demonstrations.
Now, I'm guessing that most people do want change to happen through the legislative process, but I think often the real divide is whether this change, how it happens. I mean, does it usually happen through a series of incremental small gains or
yes,
rapid sort of seismic monumental
shifts?
Well,
let me ask you, what's the rest? Give me the rapid change that happened. What's your example? I got mine, civil rights.
Yeah.
Begins in 1954.
Right.
And then a civil rights bill passes in 64. And then one passes in 65 and one passes in 68. On gay stuff, yeah, we start making progress in the 70s. We break through 40 years later. No, change. Look, the fact is, by definition, change is tough because it's a status quo. It's not a pure accident. It's there because some people believe in it and it creates its own vested interest. So change always happens incrementally. I can't think of a case where in one fell swoop the change happened.
Now, you clearly are someone who has a lot of faith in government, in governmental institutions.
No, I don't.
You don't?
No, I don't. What's your alternative? I don't have faith. I don't have faith. This isn't religious. I want to see social change. So I am working for what I think is the most effective way. That doesn't mean I have faith in it or that I'm optimistic about it. I guess I should quote to you what has become my mantra. It's a line I borrowed from a great 20th century comedian, Henny Youngman, the king of the one-liners. One of his jokes was, how's your wife? Compared to what? If I want to make social change, the government compared to what? Drum circles and smoking dope? No, I don't have faith. I have made a, I hope, rational decision based on what's available to me that this is the most effective way to bring about change.
Yeah. Well, Congressman, this has been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome.
Steve talking with former Congressman Barney Frank, the author of Frank, A Life in Politics from the Great Society to Same-Sex Marriage. Coming up, lessons from the street. Organizers share their best tactics. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. We're talking about protest this hour, and things got really tense last year in Oakland, California. Back in June, three police chiefs resigned in the course of 1 week, and anti-police violence protesters put pressure on city authorities to do more. Kat Brooks is the co-founder of Oakland's Anti-Police Terror Project and an activist with Black Lives Matter. She organized a few of those protests following explosive revelations of police officers involved in sex trafficking and the statutory rape of a young woman.
So Celeste Guap, she's now 18, but at the time she was 17, and she ran into a police officer. She was running away from her pimp, and he, in her words, saved her from the pimp, and they began a sexual relationship, which we call statutory rape. He then passed her around to at least 14 other officers in the Oakland Police Department, and they took sex in exchange for money and or information about bus and protection from her pimp. We know that the chief's wife knew about it, and so we assume that the chief knew about it. And so what we did was put red danger tape around the police station, and then we dropped a very big banner on the two OPD flagpoles that had the picture of a young woman of color with white hands covering her mouth that said OPD guilty as charged of statutory rape and human trafficking.
How did people, bystanders, passersby, respond to the protest?
Even though for a little while we were sort of blocking traffic a little bit, people were honking their horns and screaming right on and putting their fists out the window and clapping. I was a little taken aback by how invested the community was in holding OPD accountable for this crime. The other thing that was more alarming was that two women randomly walking by, one of whom broke down and said, "Where were you when this happened to me?" And that really struck us hard. And so we believe that there are more Celeste Guaps out there that we hope to find and heal and help and bring the officers who violated them to justice.
Hmm. And you've been an activist in this area, specifically working on police violence for since 2009, right?
Yes.
Do you think the continued protests, you know, the one case after another in city after city, has changed the way different communities now deal with these cases when they're brought up?
Well, we've certainly seen that be the case in Oakland. You know, one of the things that we do when law enforcement kills someone is we send our first responders team out, and they talk to the people who were in the neighborhood over a couple of days period of time, and they collect information and they take pictures and witness statements and evidence. And we utilize that to create a people's narrative of what happened, which invariably is different from the state's, right? Mm. And we were able to successfully get the state to change its story in at least two cases. And so to us, while it didn't stop them from killing people, it definitely made them adjust their strategy, which was, you know, win one.
Well, I'm asking because we're talking about protest movements during this hour, and we've heard a few people say, including Micah White, one of the organizers of the Occupy movement, that in-the-street old-fashioned protests don't work anymore, are not politically effective.
I absolutely disagree. Were it not for Ferguson, we would not be having this international conversation about police terror to the level it is. Were it not for Oscar Grant, we would not be having these conversations. We would be not talking about body cameras. We would not be seeing police officers getting arrested. I would not be sitting in this studio right now. Protest matters in terms of raising consciousness and forcing conversation that would otherwise go unhad. Where I would agree that it doesn't matter is if it is not coupled with old-fashioned door-to-door, you know, organizing, mm-hmm. base building. It goes much further than screaming in the streets, but screaming in the streets adds the pressure that you need to make elected officials have a different conversation, and it attracts and awakes new folks into the movement.
I want to ask you about one specific tactic you've used, disruption, right? So Black Lives Matter has gotten the most criticism when it has been involved in very disruptive kinds of protests, you know, interrupting presidential candidates during speeches. It's a tactic you've used, too. I mean, you famously blocked a BART train for 2 hours as part of a big demonstration. So, I mean, tell me what you did and what you wanted to accomplish.
So, again, in collaboration with a bunch of other amazing folks, Ruckus, that was the birth of our Black Lives Matter Bay Area chapter, Blackout Collective. We locked down the West Oakland BART train, which is the last stop between Oakland and San Francisco, on the busiest shopping day of the year. And we did it in the name of Michael Brown. And our goal was to do it for 4 hours, which is the amount of time that he was left laying in the street. And while that was happening, this is the other piece people don't talk about. While we were doing that, there were over 200 Africans, Black folks, in the parking lot holding healing ceremony, pouring libation, praying for healing, doing energy cleanses. It was quite beautiful while we were engaged in the active resistance. And the message was clear, right? As long as you make America's business the business of killing black people, there will be no business as usual. And we will continue to shut it down until something changes. And to our critics, of whom we have a lot.
Including some in the civil rights movement.
Even the NAACP, they couldn't wait to trot themselves out there and say something about it. You cannot appreciate the lunch counter sit-ins and say that we can't, you know, we shouldn't shut down BART. You cannot uphold Rosa Parks and demonize Alicia Garza. You cannot uplift the Panthers and criticize the Black Lives Matter movement of today. It's just, it's hypocritical. Power has never conceded. It's always needed interruption and disruption and pushback in order for change to come. And this is just the 21st century version of that. And it's working.
Why do you think people who are even on your side, though, are nervous about building bridges or, you know, accuse you of pushing away allies through disruptive protests like this?
Well, I think it's because we have a very different definition of what ally means. I think for the folks that are on our side or who look like us that are scared that we're going to make massa mad, right? They're thinking about funding and they're thinking about their position and they're thinking truly with a slave mentality. As opposed to thinking that, no, we need to be as unapologetic in our resistance as they are in their oppression. And kowtowing and tiptoeing to these fools has not gotten us anything but a 21st century version of slavery. And if you can't see that or you're not willing to see that, my bet is that it's because you're getting something out of the paradigm remaining as is, that you are actually not one of the thousands of black people that is suffering under the boot of white supremacy inside of this country. Because if you were, you would be saying, I want to get liberated by any means necessary.
You know, listening to you, listening to your words right now is reminding me of this blistering speech you gave. I saw it on video. I think it was in front of the San Francisco Police Commission, in which you basically warned the police chief that the community was coming for him. And I watched that speech, that clip, and I thought, honestly, the first phrase that came into my mind was cleansing rage. I mean, first of all, it must be exhausting. But secondly, are you deliberate about how you use that rage when you let it out, when you let yourself feel it?
That's a really vulnerable question. That particular night, I had no intention of speaking, to be honest. I was making space for some of the young black sisters that are organizing in San Francisco. And as I watched those sisters go up and speak and I watched people check their cell phones or their watches or clean their fingernails or whatever else they felt was more important than listening to the pain and trauma of these young black women. I can't explain it. I just opened my mouth and out it came. But I think that I walk in rage a lot. If I walked in the pain and the trauma of what's happening to black people in this country, to me, that's not sustainable, right? I wouldn't be able to move. I wouldn't be able to function. And that's no different than any other black person in this country. You have to get up and move forward in spite of. And so we all have our vices or things that we run to. And so for me, the anger is the easiest to access. It's the most righteous to access and tends to be with what I lead with. That doesn't mean that I don't go home and cry deeply for my folks at night. But rage is sort of what pushes me through.
Do you feel like you're making progress?
Me, Kat, no. Us collectively as a people, yes. If I didn't, I couldn't keep on. You know, I've got a kid I don't see and jobs that I end up having to work at 1 or 2 in the morning because the movement doesn't pay me, right? It's just what I do. But, you know, the Panthers had an ideology that we actually aren't working for today. We're working for 7 generations from now. And that's what I keep in my head, that I'm not going to see, and I know that, I'm not going to see the kind of society I want to live in my lifetime. But if my great, 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 however many great grandchildren do, if even my daughter, if her generation experiences a slightly different America than we did, then it was worth it. And I believe that we're on the way there to that.
Kat Brooks. She's the co-founder of the Anti-Police Terror Project and a Black Lives Matter activist in Oakland, California. Whatever your politics, you have to agree that one of the most successful protest movements in recent history is the anti-abortion movement. Activist groups like Operation Rescue and the Center for Medical Progress have done a lot to restrict women's access to abortion. According to one estimate, at least 58 abortion clinics have closed since 2011. That's nearly one in 10 clinics that have either shut down or stopped providing the procedure. Joseph Scheidler has been called the godfather of the anti-abortion movement. He founded the Pro-Life Action League, and he wrote a book that is considered the Bible for how to shut down abortion clinics. So how does he look back on his history of protest? He talked with Steve Paulson.
You know, I'd studied for the priesthood for a while, and I'm a practicing Catholic. And when the Supreme Court ruled in 1973 that abortion could be the law of the land, I simply could not stand by and watch my country go that direction. And so I quit my job, and I just sort of threw myself into trying to save babies' lives.
So what drew you to direct action? I mean, you could have chosen to go another route, you know, into lobbying, legislative work, but you became a frontline activist, you know, out on the street.
Well, I knew that legislation would be very hard and take a long time, and we were rather successful in meeting these women, offering them help, and then we spread out more to educate the public by taking the pictures, having them blown up, standing along the streets, the highways, the overpasses, and letting them see what a baby looked like before it was born, and then we would show what abortion would do. We actually showed people the victim.
And you're talking about the women, you know, usually young women, walking into these clinics. You basically trying to horrify them is what it sounds like, to scare them out of going through with this, right?
With the women themselves, we usually would not use the graphic pictures. We would try to talk to the women, and I know I would invite them out for coffee or say, do you just want to talk about this before you do it? So we had lots and lots of converts through these different techniques.
Now, during these years, these four decades when you've been an activist, there has also been a lot of violence directed against abortion providers, at least 11 murders, as well as 41 bombings, 173 arsons at clinics since 1977. Do you feel any kind of responsibility for these acts done in the name of a movement that you helped create?
We don't encourage violence. We don't condone it. But it does happen, and it happens on both sides. I've been punched around and actually lost one eye. But no, we don't.
But as far as I know, the pro-choice movement has not killed people in the pro-life movement.
I don't know. I've heard otherwise. But all I can say is it's true that the worst of fanaticism has been on the side of people who were pro-lifers, but absolutely went the wrong way. I knew some of these people that went too far. I knew people that burned clinics. I even know a man who's in jail now who shot an abortionist. And I regret that those things happened. But that doesn't mean that you have to stop fighting an evil because other evils come out of that.
So you clearly have had your successes. You also have, obviously, plenty of critics. And for some people, the kind of work that you're doing is just plain mean-spirited. I mean, a lot of times these are young women who enter these clinics and, you know, they're having a really hard time. Don't you often just make it worse for them, I mean, emotionally, to have to sort of run the gauntlet of these picket lines to enter a clinic?
Well, it's that gauntlet that's there to help them. We offer them help.
What if they don't want help, though? I mean, do you just let them go in then?
Yeah. What else can we do? We don't block them. We don't stop them. We don't call them names. We offer them help. If they don't want the help, they go ahead and have the abortion. But I've had so many women who've had abortions who said they would have given anything if we had been there the day that they had their abortion. I've heard that so many times that I just feel like I should be there much more often than I am.
But you must also hear plenty of stories, my guess is more stories, of people who resent having you out there because, you know, they want to do this and they don't want to have to feel awful about it.
Well, that's probably true. But then you shouldn't have any Ten Commandments or churches or anything that talk about evil because people will do evil things. But we're there to help the woman. If she doesn't want our help, we don't force it on her.
So I'm curious sort of at a, I don't know, psychological or emotional level, how what it takes to do this kind of work that you've been doing for 40 years. Now, do you have to demonize the people on the other side? I mean, in your case, the abortion doctors or the women who are going in to get abortions, do you see them as murderers?
You know, Steve, I don't really, because I've known people, good people, that do bad things. Now, none of us is perfect. And I don't hate the people. I don't hate the abortionists. I'm not going to judge the person. I don't know his conscience, his value system, and so on.
But there are plenty of doctors who perform abortions who don't feel conflicted at all, who feel like they are doing good work, important work. What do you think of them?
I meet with them. I met with a doctor at Evanston Hospital, had lunch with him one day, and we talked about it, and he had no intention at all of quitting abortions. Well, I found out his wife didn't like the fact he was doing abortions, so I called her and said that, and I knew somebody in the hospital that had the roster, and he would know whenever the doctor was doing an abortion, so I would just call his wife. And then he'd stop for a month or two, and then when his name started appearing on the roster again, I'd call his wife again. It was not a hate situation. He didn't see anything wrong with doing abortions. I did. His wife did. And I didn't hate him. I'd had lunch with him. There's always hope.
Do you see anything in common with other kinds of activists out there who are, you know, and have entirely different causes? You know, maybe Black Lives Matter, people in the Occupy movement. Do you feel like you share anything in common with them?
Oh yeah, I marched with Dr. Martin Luther King in Montgomery, and got some of my training, I think, for my pro-life work from my civil rights work. And I can see other causes, absolutely, and sympathize with them. But to me, the most important cause is the cause for life. And so that's what I'm committed to totally until the day I die.
Joseph Scheidler is the founder of the Pro-Life Action League. Steve Paulson talked with him. Coming up, protests don't just happen. Organizers craft them. And there's an art to building a successful protest. We'll get some lessons after this. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. We've been talking about whether protests work, but maybe a better question is when do they work and why? Mark Engler is a journalist based in Philadelphia, and he says there is a craft to protest, a series of principles that all activists can follow regardless of their cause. He outlines them in a book called This Is an Uprising, and he talked with Charles Monroe Kane.
In the United States, the idea that gets shoved down our throat again and again is that change comes from who's in office. Change comes from working within the formal mechanisms of politics. And the point that we make is that social movements function in a very different way. They function from outside of that system by putting pressure on that system. And oftentimes, they can have a transformative effect by changing this perception of what is politically possible and what is politically necessary in our society.
You know, it's interesting. I was a fairly radical anti-nuclear activist for many years in Europe. But the debate we had was three parts. Should we work through the system? Should we do some grand symbolic protests, you know, the big thing, the marches with the, you know, the dolls and all that stuff? Or should we engage in arrestable actions? Do you find through your research that one of those three is more effective than the other? Is there a way to protest, a way to create change that's more effective than the other ways?
Well, look, ultimately what we argue for in the book is an ecology of change. We argue that it really takes a lot of different approaches to creating social change to reinforce one another and contribute in different ways. You know, in the United States, you have people influenced by the labor movement or influenced by Saul Alinsky who focus on the power of building up community groups, building up institutions such as labor unions that can draw together resources and leverage the power of their members. At the same time, what we see is that sometimes these groups that are based on building up the power of institutions are sort of skeptical, or they don't have a lot to say when the moments of mass protest break out, when the Occupies or the Black Lives Matter. Sometimes they're very interested in what's going on, but it doesn't fit within that model of change. And that's why we're really interested in saying there are a different set of skills, there are some different concepts, some different tactical orientations that take place that make this a different type of organizing.
I want to ask you about a word. You use a word a lot in the book that I really liked, and that word is disruption. Do you have to have disruption for change?
Well, this goes back to something we were talking about at the very beginning of this conversation, is what are the factors that help make the movements that do succeed successful. So three that we really talk about are disruption, sacrifice, and escalation. And so the idea with disruption is that, the more that you're willing to interrupt business as usual, the less likely that a protest movement is to be ignored. So if you have 10 people out with picket signs on an afternoon, that's pretty easy to ignore. But if you have people, who are sitting in at lunch counters and demanding that they be served regardless of the color of their skin, if you have people blocking traffic or highways, going on strike, using those type of highly disruptive actions, that's much more difficult to ignore.
Okay.
So disruption draws attention to a protest. But once you get people's attention, then you want to make sure that they are on your side, right? That they see the justice of your issue and that ultimately they side with you. And so people who are able to convey the seriousness of their cause, convey their sense of moral purpose and the justness of their political demands, that is very important. So sacrifice someone, a teacher who's willing to risk their job to speak out for, education funding.
Right.
That's a very powerful example.
People respect it. If you're a teenager in Montgomery and somebody puts a cigarette out on you, people see that. And you don't react violently. I respect that. Even if I don't agree with
Absolutely.
You, I respect that, right?
So, the interesting thing about this disruptive movements is that these tactics themselves are very, very unpopular, right? The
right.
lunch counter sit-ins, the response to the lunch counter sit-in or to protests in Birmingham, this was what Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail was about. It wasn't written to the racists. It was written to a group of white preachers ostensibly sympathetic to the cause of civil rights, saying that we're with you on the issue, but do you really have to go about it this way? And this is a perennial refrain we hear again and again and again with disruptive movements. And King very eloquently addresses the point of that. So it forces people to take sides. That's what disruption does. And sacrifice helps them take the right side.
So disruption forces people to take sides. Sacrifice forces people to pick the right side. What does escalation do?
Escalation is a very important factor because the movements that really catch on, it takes some time. You know, you have to create a sense that this is not just a one-time thing that's gone now, but instead is something that's growing, that's gaining steam. You know, the Occupy movement started with a camp, you know, in Lower Manhattan on the doorstep of Wall Street, but it was a small number of people. It got very little attention for the first week or so. It took a series of escalating marches and actions to draw people down to that camp, to make it into a movement that really seemed to be gaining steam, and that finally issued this call half seriously, not sure that anyone would respond, to occupy everywhere. So groups that are willing to do actions with a higher level of disruption, a higher level of sacrifice, actions that are not just a weekend march, but that, you know, that continue. It's a strike or a blockade or whatever it is, an occupation that continues over a period of time. Those factors can have a lot more impact in creating momentum for a movement than just turning people out.
You know, it's interesting. I think if I sat down with just 10 random people here in Madison, Wisconsin, and I asked them if protesting worked, if protesting still mattered, I think the majority of them would say no. Protesting doesn't work anymore. Do you think that's true? Does protesting still work? Does it still matter?
Oh, yeah, I think absolutely it does. I mean, again and again, the major changes in our society, whether this is women gaining the right to vote, whether this is civil rights, whether this is ending child labor and creating labor protections, these have come about not because of that inside political game, but oftentimes through the social movements that put these issues on the map. You know, I agree with you, and I think it's sort of sad, Charles, that the default position in our society is this sort of cynicism. Mm-hmm. You know, it is, what does this do? What does protest accomplish? And that's why it really takes work like this to remind people at, not only what protests accomplished in the past, but what it continues to accomplish and to really affect our sense of political possibility.
Mark Engler is the co-author of This Is an Uprising, How Nonviolent Revolt is Shaping the 21st Century. Charles Monroe Kane talked with him. In a nameless city, somewhere in the Middle East, there's a gate. People stand in front of it for hours, days, waiting for permission. Permission to get on with their lives, do the things they want to do. But the gate never opens. It sounds like Kafka or Orwell, but in fact, it's writer Basma Abdel Aziz's dystopian take on life in Cairo today. Her new novel, The Queue, takes place after a popular revolution has toppled one dictator, only to have another faceless authority take his place. Does this sound familiar? Basma is a psychiatrist, as well as a writer. She works for the Nadim Center for Victims of Torture in Cairo. She was part of the Tahrir Square protests in 2011, and she says that in the 5 years since President Hosni Mubarak was ousted, the new regime has become just as oppressive.
Well, the main change here is becoming more aggressive, becoming more oppressive. Many, many people, maybe thousands of people, are now imprisoned, and there are more restrictions on the freedom of expression. Me, myself, I'm facing this in publishing some of my books. So they just come to be much more violent with people. They want to oppress any different voice from expressing anything that is not supporting the current regime.
You see this firsthand. You work as a psychiatrist with victims of torture at the Nadim Center in Cairo. Can you tell me something about the patients you see?
For victims of torture at this moment, I can say that torture become much more frequent and much more violent, that many people die under torture. And during Mubarak eras, we used to count the victims of torture who die by year. But now we are counting by week and sometimes by day.
So the number of people who are dying under torture is escalating?
Yeah. It's escalating, yeah.
You see people who have not died of torture and are trying to pull themselves back to life. Tell me about one or two of them.
Okay, let me tell you about a man who was tortured, and he was raped in the police station, and I saw blood on his clothes, and he was just crying. So this was one of the worst cases I have seen, because this man was detained once again by the police officers and re-tortured, and I couldn't do anything about this. I couldn't protect him.
What do you say when you first meet with somebody like that?
First, to assure the victim. And second is to believe everything he tells, even if it does not seem so making sense to me, because sometimes victims of torture are not concentrating enough. This is a part of the trauma they received. So I have to tell him that I believe everything he is saying, and just gradually we start to make sense of what happened. And of course, I have to tell a victim of torture that I am not offering him a full protection, because I'm not actually. So he has to make his priorities. He has to tell me what he wants to do, if he just wants some psychotherapy, some medications to help him continuing his life, it's okay. If he doesn't want any medications or any psychiatric assistance, and he just wants a lawyer to raise a case in front of the court and do lawful issues, I can tell him where to find a lawyer. I can bring him a lawyer. So it's all about the priorities of the victim. I can just give an advice to him.
How do you deal with it yourself? I mean, it's terrible hearing about it. You treat all these people. It must be traumatizing for you as well.
Yes, it is. And, well, I stopped seeing patients on a regular basis since 2012. So it's a burning out syndrome when you feel you are not capable of hearing more about this. Sometimes I feel helpless in front of the victims. I cannot protect. I cannot even bring their torturers to justice in front of the court. This is the issue here. Mm.
So you also write. What were you wanting to do with this novel? Tell me more about what you were thinking about. Because it's partly, I don't know what you'd call it, fantasy, surrealist, dystopia?
Yeah, it's all.
Yeah.
Well, when I started to write this novel, actually I was just walking downtown, going to finish some of my paperwork, and I just saw a number of people standing in front of a governmental building while the door is closed. After 2 hours, I came back through the same pathway, and I saw same people standing in the same row in front of the same building, and the door is also closed. So I started to ask myself, why are people keeping standing here? Many people, not only in the Egyptian community, like to have this patriarchal authority in their lives, like to have this father figure always. And what I'm trying to do in all my writings, or most of my writings, is to undermine and break down this authority figure and this father figure, whether religious or political or whatever.
That sort of raises the question, does political protest even work? I mean, you were there in the Tahrir Square protests, this huge popular uprising. Do you now feel, looking back, that it failed?
Well, I wouldn't say it has failed. People has broken the fears inside themselves, fears from facing the authority, fears from facing these patriarchal figures, fears from changing life, and even fears from expressing their dreams and their needs. So now they are not scared anymore from facing authority, from facing security forces. They keep on just demanding So I will just think that this will continue for a while to change the current situation.
Hmm. Do you think there will be another uprising, another revolution? And I have to say, you know, you have a history as a kind of prophet. I mean, you wrote one book, The Temptation of Absolute Authority, in which you predicted a popular uprising. And that book, I think, I'm right, was released one day before the January Revolution.
Yeah. Yeah. you are totally right. Well, let's say I'm hoping to have another uprising in the coming few years, because I think that people are smart enough to realize that this extreme oppression and violence is not the solution for the bad situation in Egypt, not the solution for the economic deterioration, not the solution for anything. And their needs are not yet fulfilled or satisfied on the ground. So there will be another movement or uprising to correct this situation. But people are now so exhausted. And I think this will take a few years, maybe. Let's hope.
Hmm. Is there a cost to you personally just saying that out loud? Aren't you in danger?
I guess that everyone living in Egypt now is in danger. Actually, many of my friends and colleagues are now in prison. So if you're asking me, I'm vulnerable. Yes, I am. But it's not a choice to give up and to stop writing or stop helping victims. It's not a choice to me. So I will keep doing what I have to do. And I'm just hoping that results are somehow positive.
Basma Abdel Aziz is a psychiatrist and author of The Cue. That's it for this hour, but there's more in our podcast feed. To subscribe, look us up on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you find your podcasts. That way you'll never miss a show. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tunkekar produced this hour with help from Craig Ely, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Joe Hartke is our technical director, Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Anne Strangchamps. Until next time.